Hello, and welcome to our program, National Geographic, brought to you by OWL Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center. I am Karen Stokes.
And I'm Dave Stokes.
And during the next half hour, we will be reading articles from National Geographic here on OWL Radio. I thought we'd start with who was St. Patrick and why does he have a day? St. Patrick's Day is mostly a U.S.-based event, though cities throughout the world do celebrate with lots of green and lots of beer. St. Patrick's Day is a cultural and religious holiday held annually on March 17th, named after the patron saint of Ireland. St. Patrick, the day celebrates Irish heritage with food, parades, drinks, Irish lore, and an assortment of green-colored things. Green beer, anyone? Today, the holiday is celebrated around the world with much of the modern traditions inspired by Irish expatriates in the United States. Who was St. Patrick? Maiwen Sukat wasn't particularly religious growing up, or even Irish for that matter, so it's a bit surprising that he became patron saint of Ireland. Born in Britain around 390 AD, Maiwen grew up in a well-to-do Christian family, complete with slaves and property. At 16, however, Maiwen was kidnapped and whisked away to Ireland, where he himself became a slave and tended sheep for 6 or 7 years. Accounts differ. It was then that Maiwen became deeply religious. Eventually, legend has it, Maiwen began to hear voices, one of which told him to escape back to Britain. He managed to gain passage on a ship, but once he reunited with his family, the voice told him to return to Ireland. Before returning, he was ordained as a priest and changed his name to Patricius, or Patrick, inspired by the Latin root patre, for father. At the time, the most of Ireland was pagan, and progress was hard won by the missionary. He was often beaten and imprisoned by Irish royalty and pagan chiefs. After his death, he was largely forgotten. But then, slowly, the legend around Patrick grew until he was honored as a patron saint of Ireland. When was the first St. Patrick Day? St. Patrick's Day started as a minor religious holiday in 1631. The church declared it a feast day, pubs closed, and observers went to church. But the first St. Patrick Day parade was even earlier, in America, according to the Washington Post. Ancient Spanish documents were discovered that showed the first recorded parade in honor of St. Patrick was in St. Augustine, Florida, in 1601. Although it was a Spanish settlement, St. Patrick was regarded as the patron saint of corn in the settlement. Since early days, the parade tradition has spread throughout the U.S. and abroad, including Ireland. How do we celebrate St. Patrick's Day? In addition to parades, communities across the world celebrate St. Patrick's Day with plenty of food and drink. The food tradition most associated with the holiday, corned beef with cabbage and potatoes, also started in the United States. During the Irish potato famine, 1845 to 1852, nearly 1 million Irish immigrated to the United States. Discriminated against and poor, Irish Americans began eating corned beef from neighboring Jewish butchers and delis. The corned beef, simmered with cabbage, turnips, or potatoes, was inexpensive and became a staple. Over time, this Irish-American tradition became closely associated with St. Patrick's Day itself, even though people in Ireland rarely ate beef. As for the St. Patrick Day drink of choice, Guinness originated in Ireland, and their flagship brew, Guinness Stout, is still brewed in their famous St. James Gate Brewery in Dublin. St. Patrick's Day revelers consumed 13 million pints of Guinness on the holiday in 2017. Why do we wear green on St. Patrick's Day? On St. Patrick's Day, cities across the world turn iconic monuments green. The Sydney Opera House, the pyramids at Giza, and the Eiffel Tower are all lit with green lights, The Chicago River is dyed bright green. In the U.S., people who don't wear the color green on St. Patrick's Day are pinched. Green is the color of St. Patrick's Day, but why? According to some scholars, the color green only became associated with Ireland and St. Patrick's Day during the Irish Rebellion in 1798. Before then, Ireland was known for the color blue, since it featured prominently in the royal court and on ancient Irish flags. During the rebellion against Britain, however, Irish soldiers chose to wear green, the color that most contrasted with the red British uniforms, and sang the wearing of the green. This firmly established the link between Ireland and the color green.
And now for something completely different. Billions of cicadas are about to emerge, creating a once-in-a-lifetime spectacle. Two large broods of cicadas in the Midwest and the southeastern United States are set to surface simultaneously, something that hasn't happened in over 200 years. This is a story by Aurelia Horn-Mueller. Sometime late this spring, under a cloak of darkness, a horde of bulbous-eyed insects will emerge from underground, where they've spent most of their lives feeding from the sap of tree roots. They will scurry up the first trees they can find, leaving behind their exoskeletons as they molt, shedding old shells as they develop those trademark wings. The males will soon begin to emit a buzzing noise, before the female bugs join them in a chorus of clicks, a cacophony of mating sounds that will swell in a matter of days. This unique natural symphony will serve as an unmistakable signal that two broods of cicadas have emerged from below ground for a rare, dual-occurring return to the world above. Quote, "That sound can be so loud," said Tamara Riel, an entomologist and horticultural field specialist at the University of Missouri, who goes by Dr. Bug. "The noise can reach 100 decibels," she noted, quote, "about the level of a jet engine." Beginning any time between late April to June, the two broods will emerge in 17 states, spanning the southeast to the Midwest. Quote, "It will be a bigger year than most," said Rial. "This is a magical event. It has been 221 years since these particular broods last emerged together. It was 1803, the last time this phenomenon occurred, when Thomas Jefferson was still in office. And according to Rial, it won't take place again until 2245. Quote, "It won't happen again for these two broods until our great-great-great-grandchildren will be around," she said. This is not a cicada Armageddon after all. Unlike annual cicadas, the flying bugs we see pop up every summer, periodical cicadas only emerge en masse on a recurring 13 or 17-year cycle. Most species tend to have black bodies, red eyes, and red-orange wing veins, a distinct coloring not found on larger and greener Dog Day annual cicadas. Geography also sets these insects apart. Periodical cicadas can only be found in North America, while annual cicadas can be spotted worldwide. This year's dual event will feature Brood 13, which emerges every 17 years in the Midwest, and includes sections of Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, and Wisconsin. And then there's Brood 14, the largest geographical distribution of all periodical cicada broods. Brood 14 emerges every 13 years also in Iowa, Illinois, Indiana, as well as the southeast in slivers of Alabama, Arkansas, Georgia, Kentucky, Louisiana, Missouri, Mississippi, North Carolina, Oklahoma, South Carolina, Tennessee, Virginia, and Maryland, and not Texas. For those living in any of the states that may bear witness to the double broods, the first sign that the cicadas are coming will be holes popping up in lawns around trees and in the woods, said Zoe Geltman Pickering, an ecologist at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. As we start hitting some of those warmer temperatures, we're going to have nymphal cicadas emerging from those holes. They will be crawling up out of the ground in just absolutely stunning numbers, close quote, said Gitman Pickering. Adult cicadas typically only live 4 to 6 weeks, quote, and will be experiencing just an incredibly loud humming, buzzing noise from their singing before they mate and die. Whether it will end up being billions or even trillions of cicadas emerging in totality is unclear, she noted. Estimating cicada population sizes is difficult, and scientists don't have a great sense of the exact numbers, she explained. But that still doesn't mean people in cicada hotspots will suddenly see double the amount of flying bugs in their yards. There's only one point of possible overlap at the edge of the ranges of both Brood 13 and Brood 14, and that is in central Illinois, where cicadas aren't typically as dense as they are in the middle of their ranges. The area of overlap is likely to be very narrow, maybe just a few miles, said Gene Kritsky, an entomologist at Mount St. Joseph University. I think a lot of people think it's going to be cicada Armageddon with twice as many, added Kritsky, who has studied the bugs for 50 years and created a citizen science app that helps track their distribution. I'm not expecting that, he says. Are cicadas bad for the environment? When mass amounts of cicadas pour out of the ground all at once, there are inevitable ecological effects. Events like these cause major disruptions in the ecosystem, said Gitman Pickering. We call it a cascade, where you have this avalanche, this small change that then builds and builds and crashes through the ecosystem. Periodical cicadas are a desirable food source for a medley of animals, a list that includes birds, squirrels, and several household pets. A 2023 study led by Gitman Pickering found that during mass brood events, insect-eating birds consume fewer leaf-eating caterpillars, which allows the caterpillars to feast more heavily on the leaves of oak saplings, a process that can temporarily damage the entire tree. Although large populations of cicadas are not considered ecologically destructive, young trees can also be weakened by the egg-laying process of mating cicadas, which can kill a sapling's branches. At the same time, the broods help move nutrients around an ecosystem and aerate soils, and there are other good things they do too. The plight of the buzzing bugs. Meanwhile, habitat loss driven by urbanization is a threat to cicada populations. Quote, we know that if anything is covering the ground, if there's cement, or if things have covered where their natural habitat is, periodical cicadas will not be able to move up through that, said University of Missouri's Rick Hall. Urban development forces the cicadas in an area all to converge on few remaining trees, which also heightens the spread of diseases like sexually transmitted fungal pathogens that cause infertility. Climate change could also negatively influence the upcoming event. Warming temperatures are certainly causing the broods of periodical cicadas to come out earlier in the spring, according to Kritsky. A smattering of confused cicadas belonging to Brood 13 and Brood 14 were spotted in the spring of 2020 and 23, having emerged off-cycle. What climate change is doing is causing cicadas to come out actually earlier in May than they did a century ago, said Kritsky. Still, what scientists know about the climate impact on synchronized cicada emergences is limited because data is limited, according to Getman Pickering. Rising temperatures and extreme weather events could, however, end up altering when broods come above ground to mate, which reduces the survival chances of those populations as a whole, as safety in numbers is part of a brood's survival strategy. Quote, we're potentially going to have more cicadas that are stragglers, and stragglers are much more likely to die and get eaten, she said. Well, cicadas on the menu. Meanwhile, a handful of daring Americans plan to saute some of this year's double brood. A professor of anthropology at Montclair State University and National Geographic explorer who researches edible insects, Courtney Borgeson, will be harvesting cicadas during the phenomenon with the sole purpose of cooking them. She compares the taste of cicada to a sunflower or a macadamia nut, quote, with a pork-like flavor, unquote, and the texture of a peeled shrimp. A lot of times, insects are eaten as an additive or powder or something that's really dry, whereas these guys you could treat just like anything else, Borgeson said, like something you might be cooking up for a taco. Cicadas are edible, according to the University of Illinois Extension website. People eat them alongside other bugs, such as silkworms, locusts, and crickets, worldwide. Past periodical brood events have inspired restaurants and eateries across the U.S. to incorporate cicadas into everything from ice cream flavors to pizza toppings. But just like with any other meat, Borgeson warns, that when it comes to food safety, preparation is key. The anthropologist also cautions anyone interested in trying to catch and cook cicadas of their own to collect the insects from historically uncontaminated environments. Heavy metals or harmful chemicals may have polluted the soils they emerge from. I always tell people, if you would garden in that space, you can harvest insects in that space, she said. Not a fan of cicadas in the kitchen, Kritsky prefers to simply bear witness to the swarms visible during emergency events. Come May, the Ohio-based scientist will be traveling to Illinois so he can see firsthand the throngs of bugs clumsily flitting above ground after years of surface on below the surface. It's like having a David Attenborough special in your backyard, said Kritsky.
Okay, next, science, mind, body, and wonder. What's the source of your headaches? It could be your neck. New research links neck pain and inflammation with migraine and tension-type headaches. Treating neck pain may be the key to relieving both conditions. The story is by Stacy Colino. There's a saying, pain begets pain. It is used in the context of physical pain, and also when someone inflicts their own psychological pain on others. On the psychological front, mounting research is providing more evidence that neck pain often leads to headaches. A recent study published in the Journal of Headache and Pain is the first to provide an objective marker for muscle involvement. Researchers used magnetic resonance imaging, MRI, to investigate myofascial, muscle, and surrounding connective tissue involvement in tension-type headaches and migraines among 50 people. Besides finding a link between neck pain and the presence of both types of headaches, the MRI scans revealed subtle changes in the trapezius muscle, which extends from the mid-back into the neck and shoulders. That may stem from inflammation among those with these headache disorders. We also found significant association between those muscular changes and the number of days an individual suffered from a headache over the 30 days prior to imaging, as well as neck pain. A radiologist, Nico Solomon, affiliated with the University Hospital, Ulm, and Technical University Munich in Germany, says these findings may provide objective evidence for the interrelationship between the neck area and the brain in headache disorders. Mark Green, a professor of neurology at the Mount Sinai Icahn School of Medicine in New York City, questions some of the findings. Quote, you can't assume it's inflammation from an MRI. The muscle could be strained or contracted, unquote, he says. What he doesn't dispute is a link between neck pain and tension headaches or migraines. Solomon's research isn't the first to link neck pain and headache. Another study in neurology found that neck pain is highly prevalent before, during, and after the onset of migraine pain. Quote, sometimes people think neck pain is a trigger, but it's also a sign that nervous system activity that goes on with the migraine attack has started, says neurology study co-author Don C. Buse, a clinical professor of neurology at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York. It can be a sign to start treating migraine. The connections between neck muscles, the brain, and pain. Whether neck pain actually causes headache or whether the two pain conditions simply coexist isn't entirely understood. But this much is clear. Quote, people with migraine more frequently have neck pain even when they don't have a migraine attack, unquote, says Jessica Alina, the professor of clinical neurology and director of headache center at MedStar Georgetown University Hospital in Washington, D.C. As far as the underlying cause goes, the trigeminal nerve, also known as the fifth cranial nerve, is the common denominator for many headaches. It connects to the brainstem and descends to the upper cervical spine, transmitting pain, touch, and temperature signatures to various parts of the face and head. With neck pain, the upper cervical nerves activate and trigeminal nerve activate the trigeminal nerve and can trigger a migraine. 75% of people with migraines have neck pain. There also may be a pain sensitization phenomenon at work. Simply put, with long-lasting pain, a person's nervous system stays in the chronically activated state, lowering their threshold for experiencing pain and making them hypersensitive to pain. A study in the Scandinavian Journal of Pain found that people who have neck pain and chronic migraine, defined as 15 or more headaches per month or tension-type headaches, tend to have greater pericranial deep scalp tenderness than those with episodic headaches. One theory is that this may be due to pain sensitization. When you're having more pain in one region, you're more likely to have more pain in another because all pain resides in the brain. The brain becomes oversensitized and pain becomes amplified. It also can be harder for the brain to shut off pain signals, says Alani. Moreover, people with migraine or tension-type headaches often have myofascial trigger points that, when manually palpated, can trigger episodes of head pain. Research suggests that active myofascial trigger points in the scalps of people with tension-type headaches are correlated with lower pain pressure threshold, which suggests a sensitization effect. Who's susceptible and why? Based on these mechanisms, anyone who has neck pain is potentially at risk for developing a tension-type headache or a migraine attack if they're prone to these.
And now for some more good news. This is why the 2024 hurricane season could be especially active. This is by Kieran Mulvaney. 2.5 months before the 2024 Atlantic hurricane season officially begins, and almost 6 months before it enters its typical peak, forecasters are already predicting that it could be particularly active. Although it is too early for any models to offer official predictions, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, known as NOAA, won't be issuing a forecast until May, well, this is last year. Experts who spoke with National Geographic warned that the warm sea surface temperatures in the Atlantic and the development of La Niña in the Pacific may create a perfect storm of the conditions needed for major hurricanes. How hurricanes form. Key to the formation of any tropical cyclone, known variously as hurricanes, typhoons, and cyclones, depending on their location, is the combination of warm ocean temperatures and the absence of what is known as wind shear. Alex Da Silva, lead hurricane forecaster with AccuWeather, explains that wind shear occurs when wind changes direction and speed at different heights in the atmosphere. That affects tropical cyclones, he says, because such storms, like their cloud structures, to go straight up into the atmosphere. But when there's a lot of wind shear, when there are changing winds with direction and height, they essentially knock over those clouds so they cannot grow straight up. And so that kind of prevents tropical storm systems from really intensifying. They also need surface water to be at a temperature of 79 degrees Fahrenheit, 26 degrees Celsius, or higher. That warm water and the warm air just above it provides the fuel for the storm. As warm air rushes upward, it creates a low-pressure system beneath the hurricane into which more warm air rushes, allowing the storm to keep growing. The intensity of an individual storm owes more, however, to the heat content of the ocean's top 330 feet or so, explains Matt Rosenkrantz of NOAA's Climate Prediction Center. If that water is very shallow, If water is very shallow, you'll stir that all up and maybe pull up some cold water. But if you have a large reservoir of warm water, the storm will keep pulling the water, he says. Record warm waters. Officially, hurricane season begins June 1st and runs through November, with storms at their most intense and numerous from August to October. One reason why some forecasters are anticipating an active season is that sea surface temperatures in the tropical Atlantic are already at record highs. Sea surface temperatures in what we call the main development region of the Atlantic, off the coast of Africa to the coast of Central America, are 1.2 degrees Celsius, or 2.2 degrees Fahrenheit, above normal, says Rosenkrantz. That's a record value for February. That means that if those waters continue to warm at the usual rate, as the year progresses, there will be plenty of fuel from which any potential storms can draw. Well, you've been listening to Owl Radio.
National Geographic.
National Geographic. You can listen to Owl Radio on our specially tuned radio or by streaming on your computer smartphone. You may also listen at your convenience on our podcast page at www.owlradio.org. Thank you for listening. This program will be replayed after 9 p.m. this evening. This is Dave Stokes.
And Karen Stokes.
Saying goodbye from Owl Radio.
Have a pleasant week. Thank you for joining us.